It's the Paris Backlash edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a recasting of the question, is Islam the most violent religion ever? Followed up by an extended discussion with our roving correspondent, Gulid, about the backlash from the Paris terrorist attacks. Let's begin episode 318.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, we're going to spend most of the show talking about the backlash in the aftermath of the Paris terrorist attacks. But to set things up, I thought I would rebroadcast a bit we did about a year ago on Is Islam the Most Violent Religion Ever? Let's listen in. Is Islam the most violent religion currently? To test the theory that Islam is the most violent religion, we need to sort of universalize the question. That is, globally, is Islam the source of the most violence? And to address the elephant in the room, ISIS, is the Middle East unique? Well, is its root cause Islam or not? Yes and no. At the moment, it is the hotbed of war, as Africa was in the 60s, Latin America in the 70s. For those who are unaware, the Middle East, sans Israel, was seen as a relatively stable part of the world if you go back a couple of decades. During the 1960s, when France and Britain were extricating themselves from their colonies in Africa, well, at that time, that was the hotbed of violence in the world. The violence was often racial in context, like duh, and led to waves of terrorist groups like the Algerian Liberation Front, Zimbabwe African National Union, and the African National Congress of South Africa. Many people forget that it was not until 2008 that Nelson Mandela was delisted as a terrorist by the U.S. government. Then in the 70s and 80s, you had the same thing happen to the very Catholic South and Central America. Of course, most of these movements were actually crushed thanks to heavy support of violent dictators by the U.S., and it was not really until the 90s that most of these nations made a transition to, more or less peacefully, to a kind of democracy. So, with that historical context, we return to our question. If Islam was a violent religion, it should be more violent globally. And it's true that in the Middle East, it is sort of correlated, but outside of the Middle East, there doesn't really seem to be any correlation with Islam and violence. Let us not forget that Muslims are the subject of terrorism in Burma, that in Sri Lanka, the violence was between Buddhists and Hindus. The UK had Catholics versus Protestant terrorism, i.e. the IRA. The US's second worst terror attack was by a sovereign citizen type. Let's not forget Oklahoma. In fact, the vast majority of terrorist acts in the U.S. are done by white anti-government or racist groups. There are some examples of violence that we don't really seem to count that are done by Muslims. Let us not forget the, quote, freedom fighters that we had in Afghanistan during the 80s. And currently we seem to see the Uyghur fighters in China as more, again, freedom fighters against Chinese authoritarian communism. And then, of course, you get ones that are getting from both sides, like in the Kashmir, which is sort of fighting for independence from both Pakistan and India. You know, if they're fighting for us, they're freedom fighters. If they're fighting against us, they're terrorists. Okay, but let's keep our focus. Islam and violent uprising. There are three non-Middle Eastern areas of Islamic conflict. First, Europe. And if you're not a right-winger, I just surprised you. Often the condemnation of Islam, the protestation of Muslims in Europe, is brought up. Most cited the Danish cartoons and the inspiration for Blasphemy Day. First, I should point out that many immigrants are still immigrants after two or three generations. Unlike here in Canada, most European nations are very strict and reluctant to give full citizenship to, quote, foreign types. And thanks to the European equivalent of Mexican immigrants, most of these foreign people are Muslims. They also tend to be an underclass, the exploited working class. So the violence that erupts over the infamous cartoons had more to do with the sense of social inequality than religionism. Most did not really care that much about the cartoon per se, but saw it as another insult to their existence, more of a caste thing than anything else. That said, as an aside, there were religious radicals who were willing to take advantage of the underlying social grievances and use them to promote both their own profiles as well as their cause célèbre, like global jihad. And this becomes a very generational thing as well. This has happened before, where you grow up and you see there's something wrong with your society and you feel the urge to change it. And the urge to change it tends to be on whatever the cleavage is of the moment. I mean, in the 60s, you had racism as the big thing. In the 70s, there was the women's movement. And the fact that this seems to be a bit more violent is because the violence being inflicted, the focus point, i.e. the Middle East, is much more violent. There wasn't that kind of violence going on in the 60s. There was a lot of violence locally, as we talked about with the SARS local terrorism, but not in the same sort of global thing. And I think that's why you get a lot of these, what is the big fear now with radicalized people at home going to these countries to fight these religious wars? And if you're sitting there and you're at home and you're in Calgary, let's say, let's be generous, because I think France would be even worse, and you've got no roots, you've lost your job, maybe your girlfriend's gone, you're feeling a bit lost, and then someone says, hey, let me show you something nice. And there are all types that will do this. The neo-Nazis will do this, Islamists will do this, Christian proselytes do this. We never get really upset when we send missionaries over to Africa to teach people that gays should be killed or that this woman is a witch and we need to exorcise her, but they really get upset when they go over there to be, quote, freedom fighters from a perspective. In fact, I was just listening the other day that Holland is changing its laws to allow a biker gang to go to Kurdistan to fight ISIS, which goes against their traditional laws because, again, those are the good guys, and we want to help the good guys kill the bad guys, however you define that. Okay, returning to our question. Globally, Muslims are behaving badly in two areas, Nigeria and the Caucasus. Let's look at Nigeria. Boko Haram is a violent Muslim militia that has done bad things. We think currently about 200 or so girls that were abducted and used either as sex slaves or hostages. Regardless, they are violent terrorists, or more generously, insurgent group in Nigeria with the aims of making a religiously pure state. Not good, not defending them. But so is the Christian Kong. Quote, a militant movement that has described variously as being quasi-Christian, Christianist, or extremist Christian. And there are far more Christian groups like that in Africa. Remember, blood diamonds and child soldiers is not a Muslim thing, but an African thing. Actually more prevalent by Christian-type groups. So it seems not to be, again, an Islamic thing, but an African thing. The same could be said for female genital mutilation. Yes, FGM is very prevalent, almost universal in Muslim nations. But countries like Eritrea and maybe Ethiopia, those are actually majority Christian nations. 9 out of 10 of the countries that practice this in Africa are Muslim majority. That said, I would still say this is an African thing because outside of Africa, it's almost unheard of. Well, at least from the data that I could find, that if this was an inherent part of Islam, you would expect it being occurred in Afghanistan, in Indonesia, wherever Islam is, but it's only in this one particular local strip of Africa that it's happening, so I think you can give them a bit of a pass as far as Muslims being the source of it, as opposed to some historical African tradition that is the source of it. Yeah, okay, so what about the Caucasus? Well, they're close enough to the Middle East and have a similar influence, imperial subjugation and Wahhabism. That's something I'm going to talk about later, but that I'm actually going to call them the same. I'm going to group them into the Middle East, although technically they're not part of it. Of course, you might ask about the Bali bombing, 9/11, 7/11, Boston Marathon. Well, yes, these were Muslim actors, but they were by and large lone wolves. In fact, in the U.S., there are exponentially more terrorist attacks perpetrated by sovereign citizens or white supremacists than any religious-related groups. Okay, but one must acknowledge that what is happening in the Middle East is at least, by modern standards, fairly extreme. Although common in Saudi Arabia, beheading is vis-a-vis terrorism sort of an Islamic development. Let's not forget Daniel Perelman's beheading in Pakistan in 2002. Beyond that, there is sort of this ongoing ethnic thinning, or if not ethnic cleansing, in the region. However, this too is not really unique to the area. Such things have happened in Africa, let's remember Rwanda, Let's not forget the breakup of Yugoslavia. But Islam is not the only innovators of terror. One thing brought up as condemnation, and justly, the action of these groups to use rape as a terror weapon, or sex slavery. The modern incarnation of this practice first emerged not in a Muslim country, but Rwanda, an overwhelmingly Christian nation. And I don't mean soldiers running amok, that's been going on for as long as humans have been around, but sort of a systematic use of rape to destroy the community. I'm sure there are other social disgraces that have been used to demoralize the, quote, other side. But I do think, though, that there is something going on here, and that, in fact, that this region has been a active war zone for years, decades if you count the Saddam years. We worry about soldiers who spend a few months over there who are so traumatized that they're no longer able to function. If PTSD affects them in a few months, what dire effects does it have on someone who's grown up in this environment? This is one point that I think supports the, this is uniquely bad, but is it Islamic? Well, there is one thread I did find that does sort of tie this all together as an Islamic plot of sorts, and this brings us back to those beheadings. Saudi Arabia has part of its legal system beheading. This is unique in the world. A couple of states sort of have beheadings on the books for something they no longer practice. It's estimated that about 60 people have had their heads removed this year alone. Now, a bit of a confession here. Most of the sources I could find refer to these as executions. Whether they are all or just some are done as beheadings, I can't actually say for sure, but I can say that definitely some have been beheadings. Another thing that ties almost all the extreme violent Islamic groups, and I dare say Muslim individuals, is that they have all been heavily influenced by the Wahhabi sect of Islam, the one that is supported and funded by the Saudi government and moneyed elite. Side note, the relationship between Wahhabi and the Saudi royal family is important. When Saad bin al-Saad unified the peninsula, he needed some form of traditional support in order to do this. The Wahhabis agreed to sort of provide the religious authenticity to the king in exchange for state support. This leads to a fuzzy but real correlation of Saad support as a cover term for Wahhabi proselytization. Now, there is a historical parallel. First, Saudi missionaries and money have been looking for opportunities to spread in the world. Often places in conflict are actually the best place to sort of find new recruits. The parallel I would make here is to the Soviet Union. They would often offer support to struggling groups around the world. And because of this social political situation on the ground, i.e. living under a U.S.-supported dictatorship, these often resulted in violence and occasional revolution. There, of course, was a parallel, one where the U.S. supported death squads in places like El Salvador and Nicaragua. Was that a plot or political opportunism? But let's stick with the politically correct Soviet drive to take over the world. It works better for my argument. So on the one hand, you do have a kind of global conspiracy, but not of socialism or even communism. Those people who believed in that system were very peaceful in, quote, settled areas like Canada, the UK, excluding, of course, some lone wolves. Now, the violence only arose in places where oppression and social turmoil already existed. Did the outside players, Saudi or Soviets, play a role in sparking a fire in fertile ground? Yes, but it was only a sect of the larger, communist and Muslim, not the movement as a whole. Unlike the Soviet Union, the Wahhabis are not preaching social justice, equality, at least beyond what serves their propagandic purpose. They're preaching sort of slavery to religion. Sorry, I still think religion is innately wrong. What else did you exactly expect them to say? But I think the threat is still there, that you have these opportunistic players who are sort of plotting, but they're plotting for their own narrow purposes, and they're not representative of the larger whole. So let's return to our original question. On the evidence we have presented, could one make the argument that Islam is worse than any other religion? Well, maybe parts or sects, but only by degree and not of kind. Let us not forget the aggressive work of evangelical Pentecostal Christians have done to make homosexuality a capital offense in Africa. They're working on bringing back witchcraft as a thing, like we're not past the 14th century. To make it extreme, saying all Islam is the worst because of Wahhabism is very bad would be like saying all Christianity is the worst because of the Westboro Baptist Church. That's the God hates fags people. And I think that's just crazy. With that as kind of a backgrounder, we're going to take a bit of a break, and when we come back, I'll be discussing with Gulen about the backlash from the Paris attacks. Enjoy.
I knew I had a problem.
I tried counting calories, eating and eating.
Nobody else could possibly understand.
We understand. We're Overeaters Anonymous, and we have helped thousands of people stop their compulsive eating and start living a healthy, rewarding life.
With OA, I am living again and loving it.
Start living the life you deserve with help from Overeaters Anonymous. Find us on the web at OA.org.
And we're back. Last week, we talked about terrorist attacks on Paris and how we worried about how France and the world would react. I hope that it might be not some irrational outburst as often is seen in response to acts of horror like this. Alas, it seems my hopeful tone last week has been rebuked by the ensuing week's action. I should point out that we're recording this on Saturday, and the UN has just passed its resolution, then Brussels has just been put under lockdown. So all that being said, this week we once again are joined by Gulit, now our special correspondent and advisor on all things Islam. Say hello, Gulit.
Hello, everybody.
So, Gulit, I should point out to our listeners that you are, well, you're not one of us. And by one of us, I mean that every co-host on the show to date has been a non-believer, an atheist, if you will. But alas, apparently you're not, no?
No.
So how would you describe yourself?
I would describe myself as, you know, a believer of someone of faith, you know, as cheesy as that sounds.
Any particular type of faith?
Yes, the one that's been in question in light of these events, Islam.
Well, I'm sure in time we'll cure you of this belief, but for now, as our resident Muslim, would you like to explain yourself and your faith as to why you keep letting these terrorist things happen?
Well, I just don't think we'll learn, you know. Well, you know, I don't think we should look at these actions as something that represents an entire group of people. You know, one thing that people forget is that, you know, Islam is a religion with a, you know, a population of approximately 1.6 billion people. And we're talking about a terrorist group that's in the thousands. I don't think we should just paint, and you know, and it's such a massive group of people with such a broad brush. And I think if Islam really did promote terrorism, we would have a much bigger problem with 1.6 billion people than what we've seen so far. Not to sort of downplay what's happened so far.
Right. One of the interesting threads that have come out of recent commentaries, especially by mostly Western media, is this, you know, idea of, where is the condemnation from the Muslim community? In fact, I'm going to play you this clip from a CNN interview and just get an idea of what I mean.
You know, I'm yet to hear, you know, the condemnation from the Muslim community on this.
We are being asked to choose our camp. Our camp is a French one. Make no mistake about it.
Well, Yasser, if your camp is the French camp, why is it that no one within the Muslim community there in France knew what these guys were up to?
Sir, the Muslim community has nothing to do with these guys. Nothing.
The word responsibility comes to mind.
It just comes to mind. You can't shirk that.
We cannot accept the idea that these people are from us. They are not. They are just the byproduct of our societies, exporting their wars abroad and expecting no repercussion back home.
So, you know, that was pretty hardcore dickishness, if you ask me. What did you think of that clip, Gulit?
I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because the more that you have to explain yourself, the more sort of, you know, the more sort of guilt you're guilty of, you know. And I really feel like they don't really need to show condemnation for these actions, because these actions aren't a representation of them.
Well, you know, I also noticed that, you know, when they say, well, you know, what has the Muslim community said about this? It's important to note that the Iranian president claimed that these were an act against humanity. The Indonesian president condemned these attacks. And Indonesia is important because, well, that's actually representative of the largest number of Muslims in the world. We tend to, here in the West, think that all Muslims are somehow Arabs and only live in the Middle East. But the vast majority of them actually live outside of the Middle East.
Well, you know, that we don't really hear about that as often. We hear about countries, particularly in the Middle East, that we're at war with, that have, you know, large numbers of terrorist groups and extremists, and we perpetuate that to the media and to our population.
Well, you yourself, you are not an Arab and you are not from the Middle East, if I'm correct.
Yep, that is factual.
And yet, I have noticed that every Muslim group, or almost everyone I've heard of, has sadly vocalized their condemnation of events. And I use the word sadly because, in a way, it's kind of like them giving in to this litmus test of loyalty, that they are in some way kind of agreeing that all Muslims are somehow responsible and need to respond to this.
I've noticed that as well. And it is a tough situation to be in, like, especially with that clip. You notice these two reporters are talking and sort of backing, this activist into a corner. One of the things he said that it sort of resonates with me is that this group is not representative of us. It is a byproduct of our societies exporting their wars abroad and expecting no repercussions back home. Because we can hear about how our government is doing, unspeakable things to these countries overseas, and not really, it won't really have a big effect on us until, something happens here, and then all of a sudden we sort of wake up to what's going on.
Yes, and the one thing that also came out in that clip was, you are a member of the Muslim community, therefore you must account for this. But the attackers themselves, they were Muslims, but they were also French and Belgians. So why isn't the French community having to come out and say, hey, why didn't you guys know anything about this? And the way they sort of, jumped this one person.
It's really scapegoating, I think. I think we just want, someone needs to be responsible. We can't see this as a byproduct of what we've been doing, and we as in Westerners, of what we've been doing. I feel like ISIL is really capitalizing on something that's sort of already there, and it's just unfortunate that there is no sort of lone wolf in this incident. It has to be something that's representative of an entire group of people.
Well, and actually, on that note, that's the one thing that I kind of mentioned in the last show that may have been a bit more erroneous, is that, we think lone wolf as an individual. Now, yeah. Granted, this was a well-organized group of people who did have some funding,
right.
But the literal ties to a centralized sort of ISIL headquarters has also been brought into doubt, that although these guys were organized and they did a big thing and they were terrorists by every definition, they may not have actually had very much to do with ISIL, other than ISIL claiming responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think it's an interesting contrast with, after the Oklahoma bombing, where was the condemnation of all Christians? Why didn't you guys speak up? Or on that note, there has been a lot, sadly, and I am so embarrassed and disappointed as a member of Canadian society, that there have been a lot of attacks on Muslims and Muslim centers right here in Canada, and yet no one calls this Christian terrorism, even though it is intended to terrorize Muslims, and the people doing it are Christian. I remember one account of a woman who was picking up her kids, and she was beat up severely, with them saying, something like, you bloody terrorists, why don't you go back to where you came from? I mean, Islam, in one sense, is no more accountable for ISIS than Christianity is for the KKK or slavery.
In situations like that, I think it's important to really look at who controls the narrative of who's really in power, here in the West. What this is really doing is isolating Muslims that live in this country that I feel are, for the most part, peaceful, that are, not getting involved in actions as extreme as what ISIS has been doing in ISIL. And I feel like this is something that ISIL is going to capitalize off of, definitely with their recruitment.
I agree with you 100%, but I am going to make one plug in there, and I apologize for being a little rude here.
Yeah.
The one thing you can say is that a belief system that allows you to basically make moral statements out of something that is, from my perspective, fictional, and to listen to someone who is an imaginary person, gives you a lot more breadth of irrationality. For example, if I heard in my head someone telling me to go out and to kill these people, I would sit back and go, Jesus, I must be nuts or something because I'm hearing voices in my head. But the premise of religion, and not Islam itself, but all religion essentially allows you to have those beliefs or have those particular attributes, and no one calls you on it. If you said, I'm doing this for the greater glory of God, well, okay, you're just very religious. Whereas if I say I'm doing this for the greater glory of Sagan or Richard Dawkins, people would say, oh my God, you're crazy. As someone from the other side of that perspective,
right,
what cushion does the idea of religion allow for people who have crazy, radical, and non-representative beliefs or thoughts to actually exist in a society? Again, if I sat there and I said, listen, I think that we should all, that we should get rid of all of the Muslims and right. that God commands this. Right. It's a lot different than me saying we should get rid of all the Muslims because I'm white. You know what I mean? Like those two things tend to get judged very differently in our society. And what role do you think that might play for someone like the guy in Norway who killed all those people and ISIS?
So I definitely see where you're coming from there. It can definitely be something that's utilized to justify irrationality. I do think that there's sort of, you know, the way our society is set up, there's always going to be, you know, haves and have-nots, you know, my religion is this and your religion is that. And I was having this discussion with one of my friends, and he was saying, well, you know, we should get rid of all religion. And I was saying, okay, but would that actually solve the problem? You know, if, cause he sort of referred to, you know, all religion as a cult-like following. And I was just saying, you know, what is stopping another one from emerging if we were just to get rid of all of them? I feel like the way our society is set up right now, problem like this are going to continue regardless of religion. It's just something that's being used to justify what's been going on.
I don't want us to go too far down this rabbit hole, so we'll leave it at that. But, you know, everyone has noted that this attack on Paris was unprecedented. But then again, was it? Because a day earlier, you had the attack in Lebanon where 40-some-odd people were killed. And in between those attacks, you had an attack in Baghdad. And you and I were talking before about how there's a certain degree of preferential treatment given when these things happen to Westerners, and a kind of, oh yeah, another bomb went off in the Arab world or Africa or what have you. You know, that happens there all the time. What do you think about that?
Well, this sort of reminded me of what the French reporter in that video, sorry, the French activist, Yasser Louadi, I believe that's his name, said, you know, it's a byproduct of our societies exporting their wars abroad. And key word here is abroad. We're having these, you know, these wars overseas away from us. And, you know, with our media sort of perpetuating what's going on in the Middle East, we've sort of associated, you know, bombings and people dying to these countries, and we become sort of desensitized to them. Whereas when something happens here, it's, oh, wow, that never happens here.
Well, to a certain degree, one of the evolutions, let us put it that way, of modern military tactics is to sanitize war. I mean, downright to the point, or to the point where even people aren't involved that much, if at all, when you talk about drone strikes or whatever, right? Where there's not even an actual pilot in there doing the killing. Although, so far, you still actually have a human in the loop. But how soon is that going to be gone?
Yeah.
One of the things I think also that plays into this is a deep misunderstanding or not quite grabbing the fact that, you know, the vast majority of people killed by terrorist attacks are Muslims themselves. So that we have, because it is an us and them sort of world, we don't see that thousands, tens of thousands of people have died in the Middle East from terrorist attacks.
Yeah, and I think that again begs the question, do all lives really matter? You know, in light of all the killings and deaths in these Muslim countries, we have sort of separated ourselves from and created an us versus them dichotomy.
I wasn't going to say anything about this, and I probably won't. But I might normally have reminded everyone, you know, the reasons like group like ISIS exist because of the failed wars and other military actions. Yes, I'm looking at you drones in the area. But at the moment, it kind of sounds like victim blaming to me. Now, that being said, what do you think about the American, French? I mean, one of the most ironic and silly things that I've heard so far is that this act was an act of war, and somehow ignoring the fact that France, Canada, the United States has been bombing ISIS, ISIL, Syria, Iraq for over a year now. Wouldn't that be considered an act of war or a declaration of war?
Absolutely, it would. But us in the West, you know, sort of our leaders of these countries control the narrative, really. If they say that this is unprecedented, and if they say this is an act of war, then that's really what we're going to see it as.
So you might not have much to say on this, but what do you think about Western involvement in places like the Middle East?
I think part of it, and which has become more commonly known now, is for economic purposes with oil. But 30% of the U.S.'s economy is built on war and their military. So they sort of do depend on going to war with other countries. And I would assume that it would be the countries that are most profitable.
I think I would agree with you that the idea that the, quote, military-industrial complex plays a big role in this, and especially some of the hypocrisies you see. As much as, you know, the West, and in particular the U.S., is railing against the ideology of ISIS, they seem to ignore the fact that that ideology is essentially sourced and copied from the Wahhabism that you find in Saudi Arabia. And yet we see the Saudis as our allies, even though they do the same kind of atrocities that you see ISIS performing. And yet just recently, the United States has just penned a huge arms deal with Saudi Arabia to sell them billions of dollars worth of armaments. And some people say, why are they doing this? And again, it strikes me as the compartmentalization or the schizophrenia that you get. Well, they're doing this because that $38 billion is going to go to some corporation in the United States who is then going to turn around and give a good contribution to some political candidate. And that's why you get this sort of hypocrisy of condemning ISIS while militarily supporting Saudi Arabia. What are your thoughts about that?
So that actually reminds me of when I was watching the Fahrenheit documentary.
Fahrenheit 9/11.
How some of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Yeah, they went to war with Iraq, and how the Bush family built a relationship on members of elites in Saudi Arabia.
I think one of the interesting things that have been somewhat of a red herring is that a lot of people say, you know, the American involvement in Iraq and the Middle East has all been about oil. And yes, that probably does play a big role. But I think now that has been overshadowed by the amount of money that military corporations are making. I was reading a comment about Canada's new role in the war against ISIS, because we're not going to be dropping bombs on them anymore, but we still feel the need to somehow support it. So we're going to send in military trainers. And then I went back and said, well, you know, what has been the record for military trainers in that area of the world? And they were pointing out that they had spent something like $65 billion to help train the troops in Afghanistan that have been just sort of collapsing. It's $25 billion they'd spent on the Iraqi army since 2004 that just crumbled at Mosul and gave... I couldn't believe this when I saw this number. So take it in heart. This might not be a real number, but I believe it. That when the Iraqi army abandoned Mosul, it left behind 2,300 U.S.-supplied Humvees that are apparently worth over $1 billion. You know, there's a heck load of money being dropped on these areas. And, you know, who benefits? Well, obviously the local groups don't seem to benefit, because whatever military forces they actually build up seem to be paper tigers at best. Whereas, of course, places like Northrop and Boeing, which make the military, are making huge profits. And on that note, you know, just to throw in with what we're talking about specifically here, it was revealed last month that the U.S. had spent, in an effort to sort of train moderate Syrian rebels, or the Free Syrian Army, as we like to call them here, over $500 million. And this program was originally intended to create a force of a little over 5,000 men, and yet it produced apparently 60.
Wow.
Hard to believe. And now we apparently have somehow got the magic sauce that Canada's going to send in its trainers, and what the Americans have failed to do, we can do. Which, I mean, we are Canadians, we are better, but still, it does seem to be a bit of wishful thinking.
Yeah, and I didn't look into how much of our economy is sort of built on the military industry.
On that thought, then, let's pause and take a bit of a break. We'll return after this message.
Conservation is the first and best resource option for BC. Do your part. Turn off the lights when you leave a room and unplug your cell phone charger when charging is complete. Visit bchydro.com to find out more ways you can make a difference. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we're back. You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM CITR, your skeptical terrorist free zone. So another thing then, we're going to shift gears in a little bit.
Okay.
One of the things that that I've heard from mainly Americans, but not just Americans, our own Premier of Saskatchewan has sort of reiterated the same thing among a few others, is that they look at Paris and they say, quote, see, this is why we can't let the Syrians refugees come in. And of course, that sort of ignores the fact that part of the reason the refugees are coming here is that they're trying to flee ISIS. Although, to be fair, most of them are trying to get away from the civil war there.
Right.
But still, you know, that, you know, after all, what is sort of the goal of terrorism but to change the mindset of the victim? And the U.S., the land of the refugee, they've kind of given in to the terrorists by offering sanctuary to, quote, only proper and proven Christian people, as opposed to any other type of refugee. In fact, I was quite shocked to hear that a CNN reporter was suspended for tweeting that in the face of a House bill that was just passed that would severely limit Syrian refugee entrance, that the Statue of Liberty, quote, bowed its head in anguish. And for those who don't know, the inscription on the Statue of Liberty reads thusly, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuge from your teeming shores. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Essentially, the United States is a land of refugees, and now they're kind of turning their back on that. And it seems so wrong to blame the Syrian refugees. In fact, I am heartened by the fact that one of the things, although France is ramping up the war commentary, it has simultaneously said, listen, no, we're taking in as many refugees as we promised. In fact, I think they're taking in more because they said that, you know, they will not change who we are or our values. And for that, I commend them. But sadly, I have not heard that from the rest of the world.
So I think that I do agree with that. I think that's very true. It is very hypocritical, I think, to sort of institute some sort of religious test where people of a certain belief have a higher chance of getting into the country. That is very much against American values. And I think this sort of isolation they're creating between, you know, sort of separating regular citizens and Muslims is exactly what ISIL is going to feed off of.
You know, on that note, because one of the things that, you know, has been made prominent, at least in some reports, is that apparently one of the attackers had a Syrian passport. And of course, that still has been somewhat of a dubious fact. So I haven't heard anywhere where it's been confirmed. But one of the ironies is that if he had a Syrian passport, that means he wasn't actually a Syrian refugee, because a Syrian passport means you can leave the country just by the planes. You don't need to do what so many of them have been doing by fleeing over the border. And again, it seems we are at our worst when we make those who are at their least suffer the most.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that is a way of sort of continuing that us versus them mentality, separating ourselves from these people and sort of creating that, well, really stopping Muslims from feeling integrated and a part of the more grand culture and people. And yeah, this is what's gonna, I feel, cause this separation between Muslims and everyone else.
Yeah, and on that note, maybe, you know, another thing I've heard is that, you know, it's a war of religion, Islam against Christians. And this is what ISIS wants. It wants Muslims everywhere to feel like they don't belong, that the caliphate is the only place for them. ISIS fears Muslims who integrate into Western society and who basically reject the really radical Wahhabism that they basically envision. I mean, the best way to react to terrorists is to ridicule them. If you think about it, the goal of terrorism is not really to kill people. I mean, that doesn't really help them. Okay, maybe if they're soldiers, sure, but not the civilians. The only goal is to inflict terror. And the best way to deal with it is to basically be constructive and not destructive in your response to it. In fact, ISIS wishes to destroy the gray zone. ISIS believes that you are either a Muslim living under Sharia law in the caliphate, or you're an infidel. The idea that a Muslim could live in and with the Western world is anathema to their ideology. That's why they use terror not only to attack the West, but induce the West into seeing Western Muslims as ISIS. That basically we are supposed to reject them as real members of our society. Discrimination, which in turn leads to the alienation felt by Muslims living in the West, who, as a result, begin to believe that they actually can't be Muslim and Western. The gray area between the black and the white dissolves, and in that, it becomes a victory for ISIS. In fact, bizarrely and scarily, and I cannot tell you how many times I have thought that we are seeing in the United States what the Weimar Republic looked like in the 1920s, when you heard someone like Trump and others who want Muslims to carry special ID cards. I mean, can't they see that they're doing the work of ISIS by isolating Western Muslims? And you know, another thought that comes to mind, again, this sounds so eerily like the yellow stars that Jews had to wear in Nazi Germany. I mean, I don't think they're calling for them to be run up against the wall and exterminated, but I have heard commentators and people of power say we should get rid of them from our country.
Yeah, and with that, that is also why I also applaud France for saying that they're going to stay with their statement and accept the same amount of Syrian refugees, if not more. And just to go back to what you were saying about how, you know, a lot of us are saying, well, see, I told you so. This is why we can't, you know, keep accepting more Syrian refugees. I mean, there's a total of what, around 4 million Syrian refugees, and a majority of them are in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. And with the Liberals' plan in Canada, saying that they're looking to accept 25,000, you know, that's still good. I think that's a step in the right direction, but it isn't a lot considering all the resources we have in Canada and all the resources we have in America. I think there was a poll that said around 60% of Canadians disagree with this plan of accepting 25,000 refugees. And I feel like a majority of us, even before this incident, weren't really too fond of the idea of Syrian refugees coming here. And I feel like it's sort of just an attempt to justify us not wanting to be responsible and take care of these people coming from really dire situations.
Well, you know, and you also get the other thread in there. I mean, we've kind of talked about a little bit more about the sort of racist element, but there's also the I don't know, nativist or fascist element in there. I mean, groups like the National Front in France and the GOP in the States, and sadly, some of the conservatives here in Canada are riding the idea of the politics of fear, that if you can create a them, that somehow will rally support around you. I mean, to the point where I'm going to play you this clip from a speech Obama made about how ridiculous the GOP's fear is of Syrian refugees.
The people who are fleeing Syria are the most harmed by terrorism. They are the most vulnerable as a consequence of civil war and strife. The United States has to step up and do its part.
When candidates say we want to admit three-year-old orphans, that's political posturing. When individuals say that we should have a religious test and that only Christians, proven Christians, should be admitted, that's offensive and contrary to American values. I cannot think of a more potent recruitment tool for ISIL than some of the rhetoric that's been coming out of here during the course of this debate. And I would add, by the way, these are the same folks oftentimes who suggest that they're so tough that just talking to Putin or staring down ISIL or using some additional rhetoric somehow is going to solve the problems out there. But apparently they're scared of widows and orphans coming into the United States of America as part of our tradition of compassion. At first they were worried about the press being too tough on them during debates. Now they're worried about three-year-old orphans. That doesn't sound very tough to me.
I mean, I think that states it so much that there is nothing for us to be really fearful about, that even if you had these attacks happen more often, relatively speaking, it is still weak tea compared to other. I mean, we live with how many car accidents a day, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And it is the Americans who quite often say that the price of liberty is blood. And again, this is an uncomfortable way to put it, but tolerating a certain amount of sacrifice in order to preserve our ideals is something that we do readily in war. And if they want to call this a war, then okay, it's a war. And that means that I would much rather live in a free society where on a rare occasion something horrific happens than to live in a police state where maybe nothing happens. And even that, I don't think is likely.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's shift to what I think is sort of the last part of what I was thinking of saying here. So we're also supporting the ISIS narrative by declaring war on them. ISIS claims to be a state, but we here in the West have largely seen them as sort of a barbaric group that has temporarily gained control of a certain amount of land. Well, in this declaration, we give ISIS the legitimacy of being a real state. It can now claim that the world recognizes its caliphate and all the propaganda power that gives them. ISIS is now on par with France. It also helps ISIS recruit. Most of the forces now come from outside of Iraq and Syria. Without this inflow of recruits, ISIS, which only numbers in the tens of thousands, at best, would be destroyed just by attrition alone if nothing else happened. Beyond these horrible, be they in the grand scheme of things, minor attacks, ISIS is now considered a global threat, akin to Russia and the United States. Bigger, with France pushing through a unanimous UN Security Council resolution, calling it a global and unprecedented threat to international peace and security. The head guys at ISIS must be just whooping it up, saying, yes, we've made it to the big league. And so powerful, apparently, is ISIS, that France has not only pushed through this UN declaration, but has invoked a mutual defense clause in the EU treaty. To what mountain is France and the rest of the world making this molehill? And it tells the world that ISIS has just won a big victory, that you too can be part of history, that ISIS claims of global domination might actually be real, and they're not. But as a propaganda tool on social media, one place ISIS has excelled, it will likely see thousands of people rush to be a part of the history, to be part of this great caliphate that France keeps talking about. Are you going?
Definitely not, no. I think this really blends in well with what you said about how the best way to respond to terrorism is to not really take it seriously and to take constructive measures. They've made more headway attacking, you know, this one Western country than they have killing millions of Muslims across multiple countries in the Middle East and in different countries around the world. Really, I think the best thing we can do is to not let what's been going on affect how we're accepting Syrian refugees and sort of painting them all as potential ISIS members. That's only going to, I feel like, make ISIS more of a threat, continue to spread their terror on us, and continue to sort of gain acclaim and continue to recruit more people.
I think you said one interesting little word there, and I think it's something that so often gets underheard. When you said the threat they pose to us, because you are part of us, and as much as many people, including sadly many atheists and secularists, want to sort of push Muslims as the other and different, they're part of the Canadian society, they're part of American society.
we are all us. And I think that was a very good way to have put it.
Yep, and that's always how I've seen myself, as very much Canadian, as very much a part of everyone else. I think me separating myself would only add to the problem, and I think also sort of turning around and pointing the finger at everyone else wouldn't help either.
And I think the important thing also to remember, which is basically what you just said, part of ISIS's goal is to make people like me, make people like you, feel like you're not one of us. And that is where they can gain their true victory. And sadly, they've gained a lot of ground in lots of parts of the world.
Well, it is true. And, you know, just around social media, I have been hearing, you know, sort of some events of people being harassed and stuff, and, you know, slick comments made under people's breaths and things like that. And I think that is definitely adding to the problem.
So then we come back to perhaps the crux of the question. So we've kind of said what shouldn't be done, but what do you think should be done? I mean, I confess, and I mentioned this in the previous episode, that I think ISIS is a horrible group. And although my personal reasons are somewhat weird, we should get rid of ISIS, that ISIS is an eyesore on humanity. But at the same time, we do have, at least us in the West, a pretty crappy record of going in and, quote, fixing things. You know, the Pottery Barn claim that if you break it, you own it. Well, we've broken a lot of things in the Middle East, and it seems only to have made things worse. And yet, can you really sit back and do nothing?
Oh, that's a difficult question to think about, sort of what do we do now? I think we should definitely look at what sort of gives ISIS power, and it's what we've been talking about, creating this us versus them dichotomy. One of the biggest examples of that is sort of our reluctance to take in the Syrian refugees who, you know, like Obama stated, are a lot of them orphans and widows.
Yes, I would agree with that. And hopefully that is one aspect of it. And part of me, and again, this is just it's a kernel in the back of my head that wonders if the way we do interventions is so much different than the way we used to. And again, I don't know if this is better or worse, but the shining winds, the shining glories of occupation by Western powers that led to a much better society has been Germany and Japan. But both of those occupations were long-term occupations, heavy involvement in the way things work, lots of money spent on building up the society, even if it meant at the expense of the Americans, as in building up Japanese and German industries, even though those would ultimately compete with American industries, that somehow that doing it on the cheap, and I know I've said they've spent billions of dollars, but part of that is because they're doing Band-Aids versus real investment, that if they went in there and if the Americans, and I don't think you could do this now, but if the Americans had gone in and treated Iraq as if it was a Germany or a Japan, you know, lots of troops, lots of control, to try and allow them to figure out their own way of doing things, because I don't think anyone would say that Japan or Germany were American clones or American puppets. And yet they somehow seem to have done something right there when every other example, they seem to have screwed it up royally.
So just to quickly get a recap of what you were saying, you're saying U.S. has sort of invested to some degree in building Germany and Japan and hasn't taken that same approach with countries like Iraq?
One inlay into that, too, might be that when the United States was occupying Germany and Japan, there was no industrial military complex at the time. And because of Roosevelt and the New Deal, the attitudes were very much more socialist than neoliberal as they are now.
And there was no industrial complex set up within the U.S.?
Well, one of the things that we have is that we have the, you know, U.S. military industrial complex. Basically, it is a cabal, for lack of a better word,
yeah,
that profits from war. And the more war, the more money they make. So they have a vested interest to maintain instability around the world. And at the end of World War II, that hadn't really taken root yet. It, by the 50s or so, it had. But at the end of the war, it wasn't there.
Okay. I knew there was a term for that, but I didn't know it was the military-industrial complex, right?
And you'll never guess who came up with the term.
Who?
President Eisenhower, in his last speech as president of the United States, he warned the American people of the military-industrial complex. And now they seem to be run by it.
So just a sidebar before I go back in. How would really the U.S. survive if they were to just pull out of all, you know, all of the war that they're in right now? If it makes up such a large part of their economy?
Well, there's two ways to think about that. In the one sense, it would devastate their economy because you have all these military companies that no longer have any source of income. Mm-hmm. Conversely, the largest single budgetary item of the United States / the world is the American military. So if they took that money and stopped spending it on their military and did it, A, as let's say a social safety net to begin with, and two, invest in other technologies, solar energy, the hyperloop between LA and New York, that those industries would take up the industrial slack that they would lose from the military industry. So now that we've covered that, let's return to the question. What role might the military-industrial complex play in the U.S. failures at nation-building in the light of its apparent success in Germany and Japan?
Well, I think that the U.S. Military-industrial complex wasn't really as present back then as it is now, or present at all. And I think sort of to feed this this need for military-industrial maintenance and growth, they have to maintain this war on countries like Iraq. And what that does, I feel, is it maintains the us versus them mentality that's been going on.
You know, one of the ironies of all this, that the big winner of this ISIS attack is Assad in Syria. Because, you know, with the recent introduction of Russian bombing in Syria and more troops showing up to support the Assad regime, I'm quite sure, and I've mentioned this before, that France now is going to say, listen, the best way to get rid of ISIS is we need boots on the ground. And the only consistent military forces that have been able to do anything have been the Kurds and Assad. And the Kurds are troublesome because they want to become their own country, and Iraq, Turkey, and Syria are all against that, where Syria just wants to reinstate the status quo. And if you think back a decade ago, the status quo of Syria was pretty good. And I think that the Free Syrian Army is basically given the boot. I think that Assad is going to be seen as perhaps an uncomfortable, perhaps a despised, but a better choice than ISIS, and that his regime will be restored and be used as sort of the ground troops to fight back ISIS. And the end of the Syrian spring / civil war is going to end with him basically being restored to power.
Yeah, and I mean, it would sort of be the lesser of two evils, I think.
And it strikes me, and honestly, I feel a bit of, I don't know if prejudiced or bigot is the right word here, but in the Middle East, and especially in the areas we're dealing with, the idea of a democratic, free, and open society is kind of unheard of. I mean, there have been degrees of all those things, but almost every country in that area has lived under a dictatorship of one form or another, usually supported by the U.S. or the Soviet Union back in the day, but they've lived under dictatorship. So the idea, what was it I heard someone say? One of the complaints they had about Syrian refugees is, why aren't they going back and fighting ISIS? Why are they running away? They should be going back there and fighting ISIS, you know? And my thought to that was, well, that's, again, like sort of condemning the Jews for leaving Germany, because shouldn't they be staying there and trying to fight Hitler? And there's just no concept of the fact that when you have a strong military force, that it doesn't really matter what the people want, that force of arms might ultimately does make right. And I do find it bizarre, and I think it will be the ultimate undoing of groups like ISIS, is that the people that live under ISIS rule must, at least to a certain degree, think that they are a better choice than what they had to live under the rule of Baghdad. And that tells you something about what goes on in the Middle East, in particular these regions. But again, maybe I'm being too pessimistic. Maybe I am being too Western elitist. What do you think, Gulen, about that idea?
Well, I think we don't really look too much into what the status quo was for a lot of these people before they went into ISIS. Really, we're really sort of just choosing between the lesser of two evils. And I think that ISIL, like I've been saying, sort of been capitalizing on negative byproducts of different societies, whereas in a lot of these Middle Eastern countries, not all, because like we were saying, Indonesia has a large, massive Islamic population, and it is for the most part a peaceful country, which we don't really hear about as much. But in a lot of these, you know, Middle Eastern countries, you know, human rights are violated. There is sort of dictatorships present. So I can definitely see how some of these people might feel like ISIL is a better alternative. And then in the West, you have sort of Muslims, peaceful Muslims, who are feeling isolated and sort of segregated against, you know, the country that they live in.
So, Gulen, any last words?
I just wanted to say that, remember, you know, we are an us. We are all sort of in this together, and it's important to be constructive and think of solutions instead of sort of pointing fingers. This is my opinion.
And we know you speak for all Muslims.
Yes.
So that's all the time we have this week. Say goodbye, Gulen.
Bye, guys. And remember, different skins, but all the same within.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.